This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
The failure was 10 years ago. That's when the investment, you know, there's been probably 20 years of fairly significant underinvestment in the water infrastructure. And now they're running around announcing their £1 billion improvement plan, which they have, and they've got plans. But at the moment, we are going to see for the next 4 or 5 years, Simon, around Kent, I hope not, but my feeling is that the quality of the bathing water will be going down.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In a week, it was revealed Medway Council is planning big cuts and huge borrowing as it battles potential bankruptcy. A new survey shows Kent Police has a long way to go to restore lost confidence, and we discovered how dodgy foreign pork could end up costing one local authority a fortune. I'm Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter for Kent County Council, and I'm joined by my colleague, senior editor Matt Ramsden, who is standing in for Borough and District Councils reporter Daniel Essen, who's away this week.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who is the local democracy reporter for Medway.
Hello.
We'll also be speaking to the KM's political editor, Paul Francis, about the week in Westminster, and special guest, Folkestone and Hythe Council Leader Jim Martin of the Green Party. First up, we're going to talk about what's happening in Medway. So what's been going on there, Robert?
So Medway Council this week announced its plans for how it's going to create a balanced budget for the next financial year. And the way they're going to do it, or they say they're going to do it, is by asking the government for exceptional powers for the next 2 years, including borrowing up to more than £30 million. This is in order to get on a stable financial footing because, as we've discussed before, they faced serious financial difficulties.
So what are the powers that they're asking for?
So the council asked for the ability to raise council tax above 5%, which would normally require a referendum. This was denied by the central government. A number of councillors have asked for this permission, but only those who've actually filed Section 114s, commonly known as bankruptcy, have been allowed to do that. Birmingham has asked for 10%, for example. But Medway's not quite in that position just yet, so they've been said they can't have that power. The other power they've asked for is to allow the council to borrow for revenue expenditure, which basically means borrowing money to cover some of the council's running costs.
So why is this exceptional and what does it actually mean?
So the rules for local council borrowing is that they're allowed to borrow for long-term asset projects. So in Medway, an example of that would be the temporary accommodation investment we talked about last week. But they're not legally allowed to borrow to cover costs such as salaries, office equipment, basically the everyday running costs of the council. This is to make sure that councils don't spiral further and further into debt. So Medway Council have been allowed to do this for just the next 2 years to keep them out of bankruptcy and get them on a stable financial footing.
If they get this ability to do so, what will they do next? What's the next step?
Well, so the council got in the Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy, CIPFA, back in November to take a look at the books, and the two proposals that I've mentioned are the recommendations that CIPFA made. They suggest that the council borrows £14.8 million for this financial year and £16.3 million for the following financial year to keep things ticking over, institute some efficiency changes that have upfront costs, and by 2027, all going well, the council should be out of the financial danger zone.
Okay. What's the likelihood that they'll get this, and when would we know, and what happens if they don't?
So the council seem pretty confident that they'll be allowed to borrow this money, despite being denied the council tax rise, and that's because it's CIPFA's recommendation. They basically argue CIPFA know what they're talking about, it's a solid plan that will ensure the council doesn't go bust. We'll find out a decision about this from Westminster by the end of the month, but we don't know exactly when that's going to come. If the request is denied, the council's in a very, very bad position. They'll have to totally redesign the budget, cut services even further than they already have, and if CIPFA are right, they'll likely face bankruptcy anyway.
There have been cuts already, obviously, but what sort of things have been affected so far?
Yes, even if they do get these additional powers, the council still needs to make savings. So parking charges are going to go up across the board by 60p per hour in every single council car park. There's going to be additional charges to park at country car parks, which previously they were free. Swimming for under 16s and over 60s will also no longer be free. And tourism attractions like the Guildhall Museum will see new entrance charges. Some museums will see reduced hours. And the Visitor Information Centre in Rochester, which also has the art gallery there, will close, all to try and make as many savings as possible.
It's always the Visitor Information Centres that seem to go... OK, thanks, Robert. Now moving on to Kentsborough and district councils. Matt, what's been happening?
OK, so quite a big story down in the south of the county this week, Simon, where Dover District Council has passed its budget, but that included an additional spend of more than £2 million because of an unexpected funding cut from the government.
OK, so, well, all local councils are suffering from funding cuts. What's so different about this one?
Well, the smaller part of it is that the government hasn't factored in business rates into the grant it gives Dover for the financial year, which the council says leaves it with a shortfall of £300,000. But even worse is that the government department DEFRA over the next 2 years is going to completely cut funding it gives to Dover for them being the Port Health Authority for the Port of Dover. What this means is that the council is left with £3.2 million less than it was planning over the next two financial years. Finance bosses there say this puts them at a major risk of having to declare bankruptcy in a couple of years if something doesn't change. The council has been forced to draw on its reserves to maintain food security checks at the port, and this is going to hit them hard.
What does the council have to do with the Port of Dover? It's a trust port, and surely this is a Home Office or DEFRA problem?
Yeah, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But not completely. So the Home Office deals with immigration and that sort of thing, but Dover Council is the Port Health Authority. This basically means they carry out biosecurity checks on food imports into the UK. Now, according to council officers, what's especially taxing is screening for something called African swine fever. This is a disease which can be transmitted by unsanitary and often illicit pork products being imported into the UK. There are estimated to be 1 to 2 tons of such product coming into the country via Dover every single day. Now, the council stresses that the taxpayer down in Dover are being forced to pay for these checks on behalf of the entire country.
OK. What else has been on the agenda then, Matt?
Yeah, a bit further north, up in Swale, which includes Faversham, Sittingbourne and Sheppey, politicians have been told that the authority has failed to meet some of their ambitious net zero targets. Although the council officers insist they're right on the right track, they're still going to miss them.
So what are these targets then?
So way back in 2019, Swale, along with pretty much every other council in Kent, declared a climate and ecological emergency. As part of this, they set themselves a target of the council itself reaching net zero by 2025 and the whole borough being net zero by 2030. Now, they admit these are some of the most ambitious targets in the entire country. And a report of the council explained that they're not going to meet their target of the council being net zero by 2025.
So when you talk about council becoming net zero, what does that actually mean?
Okay, so when we say the council, what we basically mean is that everything the council itself owns, so vehicles, buildings and so on. Swale says they made good progress. Their vehicles are all electric and they've run a scheme which has created 72 solar panel arrays across the borough, and there's more stuff in the works. They're working incredibly hard to reach their 2030 target, but they won't predict whether they'll meet it or not.
So, is there any chance they'll achieve it?
It depends on who you ask. As with all things like this, the devil's in the detail, and depends on who you go to for comment. The leader of the Green Group in Swale is a guy called Rich Layman. Now, he says through various measures, such as more use of public transport, more LED lights in homes, they can make progress towards their 2030 net zero goal. However, the Conservative group in Swale, their environmental spokesman, has suggested they need to revise the 2030 target, say, is extremely unlikely they'll hit that.
So what about you, Simon? What's been happening at County Hall this week?
Well, it's another busy week up at County Hall when the results of a survey carried out by the Kent Police and Crime Commissioner Matthew Scott were discussed. The survey was carried out in the latter half of last year and went before the Kent and Medway Police and Crime Panel. And among other things, it revealed that Kent's residents are most concerned about serious violence, including weapon-carrying gangs. There were 4,500 responses to this survey, which is quite a big sample, even with a population of 2 million in Kent, and 65% of those respondents named serious violence as their main worry. Residents also listed child sexual exploitation, 57%, antisocial behaviour or old friend, 54%, and burglary and robbery at 49% as the most important.
It's been a difficult few years for policing across Britain and mainly the Met Police area. We've seen confidence in policing take a tumble. What about trust in Kent Police?
Well, respondents were decidedly lukewarm on trust. Kent Police scoring 6 out of a possible 10. And the Commissioner, Matthew Scott, he's up for re-election this May, is, you know, reasonably realistic about the length of time it takes to rebuild trust and confidence in Kent Police. But the survey also showed that while nearly 34% of respondents thought the county's police force performed badly or quite badly, nearly 40% said the force was doing well or extremely well. So, you know, Mr. Scott and the Chief Constable, Tim Smith, will take a bit of heart from that. However, on how safe people feel in their communities on a scale where 10 was the highest, Kent Police scored a pretty miserable 6.3. And it also, in the detail of it, showed that people in Tunbridge and Malling felt safest and the people in living in Dartford feel least safe.
You mentioned there that Matthew Scott's up for election again. What do you think the chances are of him being re-elected for a third term?
Well, I never like to make predictions, but I would say that what is absolutely key for this election will be turnout. And the turnout for the commissioner elections in the past has been fairly tragic. And that will play a big part. It'll be higher in places like Maidstone, where the Borough Council is holding its elections on the same day. And I think there's one other authority that's doing the same. But elsewhere, who knows? It could well be under 15%. But as the incumbent, to answer your question, as the incumbent, Mr. Scott has to be the favourite because he's been there for, you know, 2 whole terms. But with the state that the Conservative Party is in, and he is a Conservative, it might well work against them. Funnily enough, I was joined up in the public gallery on Tuesday by Labour's candidate, Lenny Rolls, who doesn't see it as an easy task, not by any means at all.
OK, interesting stuff. So, Simon, what else have you been covering this week?
Well, at a time when Conservative-led Kent County Council is trying to find tens of millions of pounds in savings to stave off a possible bankruptcy, I discovered that KCC spends €9,000 a year on renting office space in Brussels. That's £7,500 to people in this country. And a typically brusque press statement from KCC on the subject said that it's basically used to help access European money. The statement said, KCC does not own nor operate an office in Brussels. Instead, it rents a small space in the Brussels office of the Hauts-de-France, one of the French regions, at a cost of €9,000 per annum. This is used for collaborative work with the intercontinental authorities which make up the Straits Committee and is kept under regular review. And so it went on.
And what did the opposition say about all this?
Well, Labour said Kent money should be spent in Kent, and Sir Paul Carter himself, a former Conservative leader of KCC, had this to say. He said, in the past, there was an argument for having a presence there when you were trying to sort European grants and so on. But post-Brexit, I can't see the justification for having an office in Brussels. But if you could find me one, please let me know. Well, that's your poll for you, making mischief as ever. And who needs enemies opposite when you've got Sir Paul sitting in the seat behind you? It does tell you rather a lot about the squabbling going on within a Conservative group at County Hall, particularly the backbenchers saying that they feel slightly disenfranchised and not listened to, if my sources are correct. Anyway, that's what's been happening across Kent and Medway, and thanks to Matt and Robert for your contributions today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Next up, we are speaking to Paul Francis, our political editor, about events at Westminster and how MPs have been discussing one of their favourite subjects, namely their pay, or strictly speaking, payouts made should they lose their job. So what's that all about then, Paul?
Well, Simon, let me start perhaps by asking you what you think about your MP if he or she was to lose their job in government and in compensation receive more in severance pay than they'd actually earned while in the job. I'll
Do you want me to answer that question?
I can't imagine that you'd feel that comfortable with it, neither with plenty of voters. But the issue came under the spotlight this week thanks to Labour, who decided this was an important matter and staged an opposition day debate about it. Now, the background to this is that a higher than normal number of MPs received severance payments as a result of that frenetic period when Liz Truss was Prime Minister for all but 44 days. And appointed ministers who, in many cases, had only been in the job a short period. So this is the outcome of what you get when there is a swift change in government.
Okay, so were there any Kent MPs sort of embroiled in all of this?
Well, among those who did receive severance pay was the Gillingham MP, Raymond Chisty. Now, it's important that we stress he did nothing improper and was all in accordance with the current rules, but he received more than £5,000 for a job he'd been in for 9 weeks, earning £3,500.
That's what they call nice work if you can get it. So who did the government send in to bat for this?
Well, interestingly, they sent in the MP Anna Firth, and she has her Kent connections. She was a district councillor in Sevenoaks before she became the MP for South End West and had previously tried to become the MP for Canterbury. Now, she's someone who doesn't take many prisoners and was clearly determined to divert the debate away from these payments onto something else. And she duly listed, as MPs often want to do, all the achievements that are being made by the government, which had absolutely no relevance to the debate at all, but use of a bit of time. So there's a bit of grandstanding and posturing going on across the House.
So what happens now then?
Well, the answer to that is probably absolutely nothing, unless either the Conservatives or Labour manage to get another debate. And as things stand, that seems unlikely. But Labour has set out its plans to rein in these payouts and obviously felt there was some political capital to be made out of it all. And it's true that, you know, issues around public money being funded, funding MPs' activities is something which doesn't go down well with voters. So there's two sides to this argument.
I learned something new this week. I heard a new word, popcorn.
Yeah.
Have you heard it? What is it all?
Well, I'm sure I've got a breakfast cereal called popcorn somewhere in my kitchen, but no, this is a new movement which is being headed by Liz Truss. And you might think that's a strange person to lead a new movement, given her terrible track record as being Prime Minister. The shortest living period.
Matt Ramsden's still with us in the studio. Can you tell us what popcorn actually stands for, or what it's meant to mean, or what it?
Well, I believe it's popular conservatism or popular conservatives. So one of the two, and it's the latest twist in what has been a very dysfunctional decade in our national politics.
Okay. Well, look, thank you indeed very much. Thank you, Paul, indeed for your insight into what's happening at Westminster this week, and we'll catch up with you next week. All the best. See you, Paul.
Bye.
Next up is our special guest, the Green Party's Jim Martin, who, apart from running dozens of marathons, now runs Folkestone and Hythe District Council. Hello, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Simon. I hope you are as well.
Thank you. You're very welcome, Jim. You're a relative newcomer to Kent politics. Just talk us through your journey into Kent politics.
Yeah, well, Simon, I got involved in a local campaign to save a piece of land called Prince's Parade in Hythe, where I live. And we campaigned and eventually the secretary of the group said to me, the only way we're going to be able to take this forward is if we stand for election, which we did. And she was a member of the Green Party. So I joined the Green Party and we have had something of a revolution in Hythe, because Hythe has got 16 town councillors and 13 of them now are green. So when I first went to Hythe Town Council, it was 16 Conservative councillors. So there's been a real shift towards the environmental focus here in Hythe. And that spilled over. I became the ward councillor. And, you know, in the last election, the Conservatives got a bit of a drumming, and both ourselves and Labour did better than we thought we were going to do. And that's how I ended up as the only Green leader in Kent.
Very succinctly put. Thank you very much. What attracted you to the Green Party in particular?
Well, it's really the mix of policies, Simon. The, you know, it's different now, but, you know, 15 years ago, there was very little political focus on the environment. There were some words being said, there was some talk, you know, but it was really only the Greens that were saying, stop polluting the oceans, stop polluting the rivers, you know, stop this sort of biodiversity catastrophe that we're running into, you know, that we've got to look towards the planet that we live on. And I know that a lot of those views now have become mainstream, you know, phasing out fossil fuels, decarbonising our electricity supply, etc. That's what attracted me primarily. However, you know, below that, being green is all about being fair. And social justice is a really, really big part of the green agenda. So it was really the combination of those two factors that meant I joined the Green Party rather than any other party.
Okay. Well, the Greens have been on something of a surge in Kent, decent sort of representations at all levels, including Kent County Council, where they've got a sizable group. Well, I mean, what is it that is making them attractive to, you know, ordinary voters where they didn't before? I mean, apart from Caroline Lucas, who obviously was the big name in the party, but there's a grassroots thing going on here. Can you kind of explain what that is to our
Again, Simon, it's a combination of things. I think primarily, you know, people, it's a growing awareness of environmental concerns. You know, everyone, every right-thinking person is concerned about the, you know, the all the things I listed, the planet that we live on. But I think that the surge in support that you referred to is really disillusioned conservatives. Now, particularly in Kent, which is, you know, the majority of Kent is rural, and a lot of rural conservatives, you know, saw how they're, after so many years in power, the Conservatives had trashed the economy, trashed any kind of semblance of being able to rely on them in terms of telling the truth, etc., etc. These are people, Simon, that would never vote Labour. You know, culturally, they couldn't vote Labour, but they could vote Green because Green, you know, looks to the environment, looks to the countryside, looks to things that they are concerned on. And so that is really where we're getting the swing, we think, in the rural communities. It is disillusioned conservatives.
You're not in a position where, as leader of the council, where you're going to have to deliver the government's housing targets. Now, housing is a big, big issue across Kent, as you probably know, and no less so at Otterpool. And Otterpool is a sort of new garden style, garden town development, I think they call them these days, of 8,500 houses, which is really quite a lot, built in sort of the Western Hanger kind of area near where the racecourse used to be. Can you tell us a little bit about what Otterpool will entail and about the infrastructure and how you, the Green Party would try and make it a bit less intrusive into the rest of the immediate area and the larger area as well?
Yeah, with regard to Otterpool, in the previous administration, I was an opposition councillor and I served the 4 years on planning. And the very, very, very last planning meeting that we had in the last administration was a special planning meeting where we could consider Otterpool. Now, Otterpool, as you quite rightly said, has been in preparation for a number of years, and the planning application was huge. It was a monster. The Christmas before, I had asked the head of planning if I could take the written copy home with me, because the size of that planning application, I was finding it very difficult reading it online. And I swear to God, Simon, he arranged for it all to be brought out to me, and we couldn't get it all in the car.
Oh, really?
You know, it had so many documents, we just couldn't. So anyway, I waded through it. Yeah. Anyway, at the planning meeting, I voted against Otterpool. Now, the reason I voted against Otterpool was because the planning application had an aspiration for net zero. There was no commitment to net zero. And I firmly believe that if we are building a garden town in the 21st century, in Kent, the Garden of England, then it's got to be net zero. You know, if this is the future, as the government sees it, new settlements, then we are jolly well better get up to speed and have a net zero carbon development. And that's why I voted against it, because there was no commitment. I think that we can do better in terms of energy. I think we can do a lot better in terms of biodiversity. And I think we can do a lot better in terms of the active travel plan. So that's why I voted against it. I mean, that was before the election. So it is, you might say, a sort of cruel twist of irony that it now falls to me to deliver it.
Okay, so deliver it you must. So how are you going to make it a bit more green?
Well, the first thing, I mean, that was relatively straightforward. The first thing is that it will be a net zero carbon development. We immediately started work on working out how we could do it. And we have got a fantastic proposal that we've got that will make Otterpool not only net zero carbon throughout its life, but it will actually be a net zero carbon on the day that it begins, because we will be producing carbon-free energy before the first house is built. A lot of people are concerned about the embodied energy of buildings, and the way that we've set it up, it will actually help. It won't help hugely, but it will help in terms of reducing the embodied energy.
I wanted to move on to sewage. There is a big, big problem. We've got, so-called water companies, but they're actually sewage companies, pumping millions of gallons of raw human waste into our beautiful rivers and straight into the seas off the Kent and Sussex coast. I mean, that's what's happening. Yeah. What do you think can be done about this? The infrastructure clearly can't cope when there's higher than average rainfall or there's storms or whatever. What do you think can be done?
Right, so I'll start with the answer with what we're doing at Otterpool, because we can affect what we're doing at Otterpool. And what we're doing there is we're spending £22 million on a water treatment plant. Now, this is a water treatment plant which has next to it a huge reed bed, which will clean the water before it leaves the site. Now, you may be aware that, you know, because of the problems, the Stodd Marsh is dying because of all of the phosphates that have got into it. And a lot of the development around Ashford and a lot of the development around Canterbury has been stalled simply because Southern Water can't make provision to connect because of the nutrient neutrality issues. But at Otterpool, we've got, because it's such a big site, we can accommodate the solution on the site. So effectively, all of the water, all of the wastewater, it's not sewerage at that point, it's still wastewater, that leaves the site will be clean.
That's one place. And yes. it's 8,500 houses. We're talking about a county with 1.9 million people.
Absolutely.
How do you sort that problem out?
Well, Simon, now we're on the depressing stuff, because, you know, the bathing water quality around the Kent coast is going down, you know, more or less at all points. And it is really, really a depressing outlook. Now, I have three tiers of meetings with Southern Water on a regular basis. We have a kind of officer level tier where they talk about all the technical issues. I have a political where I, you know, hit the table and shout and, you know, get them to try and do some stuff. And then we have a Southern Counties where I've joined with, I think, 27 other district councils in the south of England, organised by Wealden in Sussex, and we've jointly signed a letter to Ofwat, the regulator, asking them to take legal action against Southern Water because of their consistent failure to deliver customer needs. So we are pressing Southern Water as hard as we can, but we have no authority over them. We can't tell them. We can only try and get them to cooperate with us to try and find solutions to all of these problems. But, you know, on our stretch of coast, you know, Littlestone has got a specific problem with leaking cesspits back in the marsh, which is making its way into the sea. We've got a problem at St Mary's Bay, which they've spent thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds testing and retesting, and they can't find a solution. When we have, as you say, large volumes of rain, the Derrings in Lydd, they've been through terror with the sewer. The pumps are becoming overwhelmed and the sewerage backing up in the people's homes. At Range Road in Hythe, when during Storm Ciarán, we had pump failure, and they pumped 500 hours of neat sewage into the sea.
Okay.
They're currently relying on tankers to move, you know, to literally move the sewage around.
Do you think that if there was a sanction by which bring someone to court, charge them criminally for acts of river poisoning or whatever, would you agree with that? Would you like to see some people take?
I mean, that's why I signed the letter to Ofwat, you know, for legal action. Whether it results in anything like that.
Well, talk about criminal charges.
Yeah. But let me make it clear to you, because in all honesty, Simon, 2 years ago, I knew nothing about this. You know, I am an acknowledged flipping expert now because I've had to do so much work on it. But the failure was 10 years ago. That's when the investment, you know, there's been probably 20 years of fairly significant underinvestment in the water infrastructure that has resulted in it. And now they're running around announcing their £1 billion improvement plan, which they have, and they've got plans. But at the moment, we are going to see for the next 4 or 5 years, Simon, around Kent, I hope not, but my feeling is that the quality of the bathing water will be going down.
Okay, let's just finally move on to your thoughts on the Kent County Council elections, which will be held in May next year. You've got quite a small group on the council, but it's roughly of a similar size to all the other opposition groups like the Lib Dems and the Labour Party. I would imagine that the Greens are feeling quite confident that they can pick up a significant number of seats next time. What's your assessment of that?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree, Simon. I'm not at the sort of front line on that, so I can only really just kind of speak as I find. But KCC are in desperate trouble. They have got a deficit that is huge, and if they survive, they're planning to survive this year by dipping significantly into their reserves. Next year, who knows? It's going to be a really, really important election. And, you know, I've never been a part of KCC, but my interaction with them is things need to change. You know, we need a new way of doing things. You know, this kind of conservative-led old boys club has really got to end once and for all, because it just is not working.
Listen, Jim Martin, thank you very much indeed for your time, and I hope to speak to you soon.
Okay, thanks, Simon.
Well, that's it for this week's Kent Politics Pod. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to tune in to KMTV on Fridays at 5 p.m. for its politics show, and we'll be back next week with more top news and analysis. All the best now.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.